You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
During my lifetime, scientists and the popular press portrayed Greenland as long frozen over millions and billions of years. Now that seems doubtful. According to a new study published in the journal Nature, Greenland could have been mostly ice-free sometime during the last million or so years, and maybe it could go back that way. The title is Greenland was nearly ice-free for extended periods during the Pleistocene. Now, is that just a matter for ice geeks? The lead author, Dr. Jorg Schaefer, says the massive Greenland ice sheet might go again, and might go again soon. That would create an ocean several meters higher, rewriting all our maps and cities around the world, so it is important. The global models that predict our climate have not had time to include this new information developed from a cutting-edge scientific technique. Jorg Schaefer is an adjunct professor at the Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences at Columbia University. He's also a research professor at the respected Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory just north of Manhattan. Educated in Germany and Switzerland, speaking four languages, Schaefer is a specialist in a rare new technology called cosmogenic dating. We'll get to that as we explore the past, hoping for a mirror to see the future. Dr. Schaefer, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Welcome. Thank you very much for the introduction.
So before your new study, how would you summarize the general consensus about how long this great Greenland ice sheet had been there?
Well, I mean, that was always a worry, and it was an open question. But you are right in your introduction that in general, over the last years at least, it looked like that Greenland might be not our first worry in terms of ice sheet melt. A lot of worries was really focused on the Western Arctic ice sheet that is marine-based. That means the bedrock underneath it is below sea level. And these ice sheets are inherently vulnerable and unstable. Greenland was mostly kind of looked at as a huge ice cube sitting on bedrock. And, of course, Arctic warming is significant. But if you only melt an ice cube from the top, it takes an awful long time to do that, if that is all that's happening. So before this study, we were not that worried, I would say. And I wished, really, looking back, we could have confirmed that. But unfortunately, our results spoke very clearly, and now we are very worried about Greenland.
Why is it so difficult to map out when Greenland was covered with ice and when it was mostly ice-free?
Well, yeah, I mean, it is very simple, but these big problems, everybody wants to know what happened to these ice sheets in the past, because that's really the information that you need to predict what's happening in the future. And so many people try to do that, but it's really complicated because the geological record, the direct record, are these bedrocks underneath the ice, and they are covered by kilometers of ice and are extremely hard to get to. And that's where the primary records sit. And we were lucky enough to get the first piece of rock underneath such an ice sheet in Greenland. And that's this, and when they drilled in the 1990s, finished 1993, the famous GISP 2 ice drilling, where they've retrieved an ice core of almost 2 miles for climate, that gave us this fantastic climate record that we have. They drilled into bedrock, and that is just the only sample we have in the moment. And one of my big hopes is actually that we have proven how valuable these archives are, and that we are now trying to get to them more frequently and more directly. These bedrocks underneath ice sheets hold the information, and we can map them out and measure them out, and that's what we need to do now.
Yeah, below 2 miles of ice, it's almost as though you got a rock from the moon or something. They're rare. So if it was captured in 1993, why wasn't this type of analysis done until now?
The pioneer who was on the ice sheet of this kind of analysis we have applied and that we are experts in, Bob Finkel, he was part of that team in 1993, and he became a good friend of mine when I arrived in the United States in 2000. And he and his colleague Kunishi Tumi, they did, when they retrieved this bedrock core in 1993, already then with the idea applying this technique, which basically gives you a measure of how long was the bedrock exposed to the open sky, so basically was ice-free. They tried that in the 90s, and they were super leading back then, and they could measure something, but it was just not precise enough and accurate enough to really make climate and ice sheet histories out of the data. And it just really literally took us 20 plus years to get these methods refined to a degree that they now really release all the climate information and the ice sheet history information that are stored in these bedrocks. So it was really geeky geochemical and analytical development that was needed. And that finally we managed to get there. And with Bob Finkel together, we finally were able to get the pieces of rock, because, I mean, they're kind of super, as you said, extremely precious rocks. So it was not easy to convince the sample assignment committee to give us samples, but finally, thank God they gave us samples, and now I think the data set speaks for itself. It's very, very internally consistent, very robust, and it tells us a very clear story, even if it's not the story we were hoping for.
So should we try and explain to our listeners what cosmogenic nuclide dating is?
Yeah, we can try that quickly. I know it sounds much more exotic than it is. Really, the basic principle is that the Earth and the Earth's atmosphere is constantly bombarded by primary cosmic rays. These are energy-rich particles or radiation from outer space. These are protons, and then the protons interact with the nuclides, or with the atoms in the atmosphere, and make kind of a complicated nuclear reaction cascade. But the secondary cosmogenic nuclides that form, which are neutrons and muons, they constantly bombard the Earth's atmosphere. And they are still powerful enough to produce certain nuclides that we call cosmogenic nuclides in the Earth's surface rocks. And they are only produced by these cosmic rays. So as soon as you measure them, you know you had a near-surface rock exposed to the open sky. So it's not the sun, it's really coming from the outer space. And these rocks that contain these nuclides have seen the open sky, and these cosmogenic nuclides are produced as a function of time. So that's basically, we are counting these atoms and translate them into time the rock was near the Earth's surface. So exposure dating is really what this is. And in this particular case, we used two radioactive nuclides together. They are produced in a mineral that we particularly like, quartz. And these two nuclides, beryllium-10 and aluminium-26, they are produced basically as twins in that nuclide. However, the one twin, aluminium-26 twin, is produced about seven times more frequently than the beryllium. And if you then shield the surface after the production, if you, for example, build an ice sheet on top of that surface that, of course, shields the incoming cosmic rays, and then only the radioactive decay is at work, and this ratio, production ratio between aluminium-26 and beryllium-10, that was 7, starts to decay because aluminium-26 decays twice as fast. So if you come after a time T of ice sheet beryl, and you measure something and the ratio between 26 and 10 that is lower than 7, then you can translate that into a period during which this ice sheet was continuously covering that piece of bedrock.
All right. I think we've got enough for listeners there. And listeners, there will be a pop quiz at the end of this interview, so I hope you're taking notes. Okay, now look, I'd like to move on to the big reason, or one of the big reasons that we really care about that, and that is sea level rise. Scientists have various ways of measuring past sea levels. It asks me the question, if Greenland was nearly ice-free in the last million or so years for extended periods, wouldn't that be reflected in several meters of sea level rise? Did scientists find these times? That is, does the time map of sea levels correspond to the possible findings of your study?
Yes and no. I mean, yes, they do. You probably should not directly compare them. So finding past markers of sea level is really tricky. And the longer back in time you go, the trickier it gets and the more harder to analyze these sea level proxy records become. So the biggest discussion in the moment in the sea level community is the last interstadial period. So what we call marine isotope stage 5E, or the Europeans call it the Eemian. I think it's now pretty well documented that this interglacial was even warmer than we have it today. I mean, we'll probably pass that at one point soon, but overall the temperatures seem to be warmer. And there is almost, I think now, agreement that the sea level also was higher during 5E. The problem is you don't really know from which ice sheet that came. So we, of course, know that the Laurentide ice sheet, the big ice sheet, major piece and driver of ice ages, was 20,000 years ago during the last glacial maximum, covering half of the American continent, and then it was decaying over the next 10,000 years. And that coming and waxing and waning Laurentide ice sheet is worth about 120 meters of sea level. But the sea level was another 5 or 6 or maybe even 7 meters higher during the last interglacial. And nobody really knows where this came from. And as I said at the beginning, most people would have put their money on the West Antarctic ice sheet. We don't say in this paper that we have evidence, because we don't. We have don't have direct evidence that marine isotope stage 5e, the Greenland ice sheet, was nearly gone. But given our record, it certainly is a possibility that it's happened.
Well, yeah, I want to ask you about that, because in the December 16th issue of the journal Science, one of your co-authors, Richard Alley of Penn State, released a new estimate of his sea level rise projections with Michael Oppenheimer, and they project seas 2 meters or over 6 feet higher by the end of this century, but they cite a larger contribution from the Antarctic, not from Greenland. And that got me wondering, is the near-term melt from Greenland one of these things that's high risk but low probability? When I say near-term, I'm talking about this century.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not convinced that where Richard Alley's group comes from, they have identified ice sheet sections in Antarctica that are much more unstable from the ice sheet dynamic side than we were thinking of. So just in general, the areas of concern, if it comes to the Antarctic and the Greenland ice sheet, become bigger and bigger. That kind of early prediction does not include Greenland yet. That was really based on an update of their finding from Antarctica, which they were very concerned about. Probably you would wonder if that an updated prediction curve would be even steeper, because now Greenland is on the map again. But to be clear, right, all we say in this paper for now, and we haven't done any ice sheet dynamics, all we say is the observational record from this really good observation spot that we have gives us direct evidence that Greenland was much more dynamic than we thought before. And we don't push one particular scenario. We just say it was during the Pleistocene for a much longer period than we thought. So more than 200,000 years was ice-free over the last 2.5 million years.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. As you know, I'm your host, Alex Smith. Joining me from Columbia University, New York, is scientist Jörg Schaefer. Along with Richard Alley and others, Schaefer is the lead author in a new paper revealing Greenland may have been close to ice-free relatively recently, and it could unexpectedly return to that state as humans heat the planet with greenhouse gases. Jörg, as you know, a second letter on the Greenland ice sheet was published in the same December 7th edition of the journal Nature. The title is A Persistent and Dynamic East Greenland Ice Sheet Over the Past 7.5 Million Years. Vermont scientist Paul Bierman is the lead author of that. It sounds like a conflict with your findings, is it?
No, it's not. I mean, first of all, it's a big day for our method, because we are using the same tools. And I know Paul well as a close colleague, and as we are, he's specialized in making these cutting-edge analysis. No, I don't think so. As we lined out in our paper and also in the news and views in this issue of Nature, these authors reflect the same view. These two studies can be really easily reconciled. So I don't want to talk too much about Paul's excellent paper. They observe erosion under the ice sheet, and they do so in looking in a proxy record, which are the sediment that are reaching the ocean floor of East Greenland. And what basically one of their findings is that there's fluctuations in the intensity of that subglacial erosion signal, but it's what they see in there with the resolution they have, they see it basically being there all the time. So it was kind of continuous. So that means you need some kind of glacial ice on Greenland that does this erosion. So the reason why we titled our paper Extended Periods of Nearly Ice-Free Greenland is exactly that we have one point of observation, which is underneath the GISP 2 ice core. It's very central. It's at the point of the highest ice, the ice sheet summit. So all the models agree that this point is one of the latest points to deglaciate. So if Greenland ice sheet decays, the GISP 2 bedrock site is at the very, very end of this deglaciation period, but it's not the total end. So you can deglaciate, or you probably have deglaciated this GISP 2 bedrock site, and there was still some ice on the eastern highlands. If you go from the GISP 2 site to the east, you climb up basically a mountain, and there are the eastern Greenland highlands. And the easiest way to reconcile Paul's and our paper is that Greenland was 90% ice-free, maybe 95% ice-free, but there was still ice on the eastern highlands producing that erosion signal that Paul sees. So no, I don't think so that there's a problem with that at all. It's actually very important to see that, because what this means is that remaining ice in the eastern highlands, that would be also the nucleation point for the new ice sheet. So if you reform it after this warm period, it gets colder, and then you reform the ice sheet, and Paul basically has identified the area where the new ice sheet reforms. So that's a very important constraint for the ice sheet models. And in general, these two observational studies that are published now, we really hope that we kind of together can intensify the collaboration with our ice sheet physics colleagues and the ice sheet modelers and come up with a new generation of more realistic Greenland ice sheet scenarios, which will be more dynamic. And please note that Paul's paper also has the word dynamic in the title, which is very important. So.
Well, I guess the question most of my listeners are going to be asking themselves is, Jörg, do we have any idea how fast Greenland could lose substantial amounts of ice?
And that my answer in the moment is no, we don't. What I think we can say is that the existing Greenland ice sheet models that we have are too conservative and too stable. So whatever we will produce in the next year or two in terms of new and more realistic and more dynamic Greenland ice sheet model simulations, it will be a significantly more aggressive picture in terms of ice loss. And we don't really know the process yet, I think. I mean, that will be the big discussion point. So it feels to me that we are missing something either in the paleo climate scenarios that are driving these ice sheets or in the ice sheets themselves. I cannot tell you what this is, and I really cannot tell you the time scale about Greenland deglaciation before we have identified the physical process. But I am very optimistic that, I mean, probably my colleagues, and hopefully with our help, will identify that. And they will identify if it's the climate forcing that was much bigger than we think, which Richard Elliott favors, or if it's something in the ice sheet physics that we are really missing. So we'll see. So no, in the moment, I would not like to put out any number that has really no basis in the moment. But I am worried about reaching a threshold or a tipping point in the Greenland ice sheet stability pretty soon. We have actually more work going on. I don't know if you have a question for that, what we are doing now as a next step.
I'm interested. Please tell us.
So in the moment, we are basing all our, this paper is based on the beryllium and the aluminum exclusively. There's also another nuclide produced, not in quartz, but in feldspar, chlorine 36, that has, again, less than half of the half-life, so it decays twice as fast as aluminum. And we are in the moment going through the very tedious process to measure that. And that should give us actually, hopefully, an idea that should answer us the question if the Greenland ice sheet was gone over the last 500,000 years, so on the shorter time scale. And that is really critical, because then it hopefully can give us a better idea, was it ice-free during the last interglacial or not, where we have a lot of other proxy data that we could use then to really estimate and quantify the sensitivity of the Greenland ice sheet. But that's going on. This is all happening in the next year or so. Again, before I'm giving out a number now that I cannot hold, I would rather wait for a year and then we are much further. And then I'm pretty optimistic that we can give you a much better answer and a really informed answer about that crucial question. There's no question that we know how important that is. But that's also the reason why I would, as scientists, rather stay conservative and make sure that we have the right information.
I understand. Well, we need more research, and you've said in a video made for Columbia University that it's just a matter of funding to find out when and how fast Greenland could revert to its low ice state. And I'm wondering, do you have worries about funding now that the incoming American administration is loaded with outright climate deniers who want to chop off climate change research? Could that affect your work or your observatory work? or can private donors fund this research?
Yeah, I mean, that no question, would the decrease or suppression of federal funding of climate research would certainly have an effect and would slow down things. However, I mean, the U.S. is not alone. What it would really do primarily, this would cut off the leadership of the U.S. science community in that field. If you made these kind of first kind of breakthrough studies that clearly show that these techniques are available, and I mean, the U.S. is blessed to be in clearly in the leading spot also from the analytical side in the moment that, I mean, you need these crazy machines, kind of mass specs coupled to a particle accelerator to measure these nuclide systems, and the U.S. has just simply the two best facilities on Earth, maybe followed, including one from Australia that we are working with for the Chlorine 36 project. That's Keith Fifield at ANU. So, but these three are clearly leading, and if the funding would go down significantly, then we would lose this leadership. But these questions, the climate system is so much bigger than an administration or one or even two election cycles. People will work on this. It will be painful for me personally, but it will not halt the overall science in that. And again, I mean, many of us are so committed. This is really the forefront, one of the forefront problems that we need to tell society, and we have to, politicians have to prepare society, not only in the U.S., but also in the U.S., for what is coming there. And I really think we have now opened a new chapter where we have these tools in place to do these direct studies. And, I mean, drilling through kilometers of ice to get through bedrock, this is certainly not cheap, but it's also not outrageously expensive. So, I mean, you're not talking mega projects like a NASA mission or something. This is mid-funding level, I would say. So I'm still hoping, simply because I had such a wonderful journey here in the U.S. science world so far. Maybe I'm just too naive, but I just cannot believe that this is now stopped and taken away from us, now that we are basically in a position to continue to lead and finish this job with the U.S. colleagues here.
Yes, just as we can find out. You know, I found your letter, Jorg, in Nature very disturbing, even on a personal level, because once again, the entire picture we had of the stability of nature has been questioned, if not thrown out, and it takes us closer to an emerging state of chaos. Do you think that's where we're headed, Jorg? Is it climate chaos coming?
I don't like this word climate chaos. I generally don't like I stay away from everything that kind of could trigger hysteria. Do I think this will be one of the biggest challenges, or the biggest challenge maybe, that our overpopulated planet faces in the next, not 200, but in the next 50 years? Yes, I do think this is correct. This is true. I also do think that it is not completely too late yet. There is a lot of progress in that field in many aspects. This kind of science and understanding of what is happening had made huge jumps forward. Admittedly, most of the big findings we have to report are worrisome. But then again, I'm just on the longer time scales. I'm not willing to believe that this is a challenge that mankind cannot stem. But we have to really look into it. And what we cannot afford is to behave like it's not a problem. And any state and any government that would do that will just simply fall back behind others. And that's certainly not what we want in the U.S.
No, we want to make America great again in the science community as well.
You said that. Well, we are pretty good, actually. America was not in a bad shape, as far as I can tell. And in the science world, that's one of the reasons why I am, and my wife, she's also a research professor here in the same institution, and also teaching at Columbia. We are both Germans, and we are both here and have decided to raise our kids because of this incredible depth and breadth of scientific intellect that is not only here at the West. I mean, Columbia is a fantastic place, but in general, there are many areas and many institutions in the U.S. that are just absolutely world-leading in that aspect. So we don't want to lose that. No, we don't.
Is there anything you would like to add?
No, it's just this is a personal, almost personal aspect here. There is an upcoming center here at Columbia called the Center for Climate and Life. And first, I would like to add, if that is possible, that I'm also a scientist of the Center of Climate and Life. And that is one of the big centers that looks into the opportunities to find private funding for these kind of researches. At one point, you kind of asked me if there is chance to find private funding for these projects, and I think at least seed funding, this hopefully would be possible.
It should be possible because, you know, Jeff Bezos of Amazon and Bill Gates of Microsoft and others, including Richard Branson, have just announced a new $1 billion formation of a company to develop renewable energy and low carbon energy. So I could see that perhaps private funding will replace some of the government funding if needed.
Yeah, let's hope. Let's hope, at least as a bridge. I mean, again, the kind of the U.S. also, the funding rate didn't go up as we were hoping for geoscience in general and for climate science, but it still was a very functional system, and it still is a very functional system. So I'm not one of these people who say if you have to, that federal funding doesn't work anymore, we need private. But now with the recent developments in politics, there's no question that it would be certainly a good idea and good to know that there are private philanthropists who are willing to at least bridge these kind of the science that leads into the answer of these kind of questions. And I just wanted to acknowledge that affiliation to the Center of Climate and Life, because that will be hopefully a very important player here in Colombia.
Is it already up on the web or is it coming?
It's up on the web. I send you a link.
Okay. I'll put that in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Listeners, we've been hearing about a new factor in the climate threat. Instead of being a steadfast giant of ice, science can now reliably show that parts of Greenland have been ice-free in the not-so-distant past. It could revert to that state with catastrophic consequences as global coastlines flood. Our guest is Dr. Jorg Schaefer. He's from the Lamont-Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia University. We've been discussing the startling paper Greenland was nearly ice-free for extended periods during the Pleistocene. That was published in the journal Nature on December 7th, 2016. Find all the links you need to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Thank you so much for talking with us, Jorg Schaefer.
Okay, thank you.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.